This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. The last thing Washington social workers want to do is to take children away from their parents. What usually puts kids into foster care is drug abuse. But while the social workers scramble to find a safe placement, where do the children stay in the meantime? In Bellingham, a new program aims to eliminate that foster care gap. Here's reporter Sarah Eden Wallace.
Alex Vistron is a supervisor at Child Protective Services in Bellingham. He's one of those social workers racing against a ticking clock to find foster homes for kids. It usually takes a few days, so that means the office often looks like a daycare.
You know, it's a big office. They run around in huge circles in and out of cubicles. You're filing dependencies, you're going to court, you're doing a lot of work, and it is not easy necessarily to be caring for a 2 or 3 year old throughout that time as well.
All the social workers pitch in, taking turns watching kids for half an hour, 45 minutes. Vistron recalls one kid in particular.
The little guy we started calling Peanut slept on the couch here in the office. He spent a lot of time with social workers just going around the office.
But there was a happier solution for Peanut and his sister.
In this case, we did find Skookum, and both kids were able to go to Skookum, which was great.
This bedroom we call the flex room.
Skookum House is a new kind of temporary foster care home. Kids can stay for up to 72 hours until they go to a permanent home. The legislature authorized this kind of group home care in 2013. Skookum was one of the first places to open up.
This is the girl room, and it's very
It looks clean. Like any other house so in its cozy Bellingham neighborhood, with flowers by the doorstep and a swing set in the backyard. Ray Deck directs Skookum.
What we do is we buy time for the social worker to do that investigation and make a decision about what is the best place for the child to be.
How was breakfast? Good?
On the day I visited, two sisters had just arrived. They were eating breakfast and getting the lay of the land.
Can we go look at the yard?
Yeah, we'll be able to go out and look at the yard, yeah.
Again, Ray Deck.
When you're entering foster care, that's a big giant bowl of mystery. How long am I going to stay here? When can I see my mom again? Is my mom all right? We get to show kids that being in foster care isn't scary by giving kids a really fun weekend for their first weekend in foster care sets the tone and calibrates their expectations about what the future is going to be.
I saw somebody make their bed really nicely. That was you. Wow.
The kids sleep in bunk beds with homemade quilts. They're fed home-cooked meals, taken to doctor's appointments, to the playground, to a donut shop, maybe for the first time in their lives.
So whenever you're ready, come on down.
Only 10% of Skookum's funding comes from the state. It runs mostly on donations. 130 volunteers work here. Sarah Ann Evans is one.
One child had spent a majority of their time in a vehicle. That's how they lived. That's where they slept. And this child was intense energy. We just played along. I mean, right? That's what we get to do. We get to play. Like, when we come, I don't really have to parent. I get to play and have fun.
Evans was once in foster care herself as an infant and was later adopted. She's a full-time mother of three, so she feels for these kids, how they need to jump on comfy couches and build pillow forts.
As a mom, if I can just give them, like, comfort and that safety and a fun time and yummy food, then that's what I can give these children.
It's important because these kids face huge problems. 90% are victims of neglect. They've operated without the support of parents. Their focus has been on surviving. Skookum's Ray Deck.
If you're spending all of your emotional energy and your physical energy keeping yourself alive and keeping the people around you alive, you're not spending that time learning how to make friends or learning your times tables or learning fractions. The only way to resolve it is for kids to have a safe place where they're cared for and allowed to be children.
And there's more, according to social worker Fitzstron.
There are a lot of children that have sort of attachment disorder concerns, meaning that they will come in here and it's as if they never were there. We have children within minutes calling social workers mom or dad, or because they never had that bonding.
Who's missing socks?
Well, I found some in the thing.
So oh, good.
There are only two other homes like Skookum in the entire state of Washington. Fitzstron says he could use 5 just in Whatcom County. Until that happens, there's a small fleet of battered strollers in the Bellingham offices where he works, and a host of social workers taking turns wheeling kids around the cubicles. In Bellingham, I'm Sarah Eden Wallace, KOW News.
This is KUOW's The Record here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Gentrification is not a new story here in Seattle. KUOW's growth and development reporter Joshua McNichols told us earlier this week how some people in South Seattle are dealing with gentrification in their neighborhoods. Some of them are seeking out the help of Pedro Gomez with Seattle's Office of Economic Development. Gomez helps people who might get pushed out of a gentrifying neighborhood stay by starting their own small business. He's got his own experience with entrepreneurship, starting when he was about 8 years old.
I grew up working in the farms in California, in Oregon, Washington. We grew up as migrant farm workers. And in Fresno, California, there was a point where the governor of that state passed a law where kids weren't allowed to work on the fields anymore. So my parents, they couldn't pay for a babysitter, so they brought us to the fields anyway. And that's the case a lot of times of why farm workers will bring their kids to the fields is because they can't really hire babysitters, so they bring them and then you put them to work, might as well. So I couldn't work on the fields anymore, but we had to figure out how can I still be productive while I'm there. So my parents bought me a wagon and a big cooler, filled it up with sodas and water, and I would go around the field selling sodas and water to the farm workers. And there was a little radio, and I would sing songs, and I was competing with the taco trucks that were there to serve the farm workers, and I would lower my prices sometimes just to compete with them, you know. And so that's a funny story of how I first started getting into the whole business world, you know. But
you were learning about bartering. You were learning about, okay, what do I have that's, okay, radio, singing. That's a hook. That's different.
Yep. I've always been a huge fan of a Mexican group called Los Tigres del Norte, which I just got to see for the first time last weekend. And in their music, they talk about the struggle of the immigrant and the struggle of being a farm worker and all that. And those are the songs I would sing when I was in the fields, and they would attract customers, you know.
Eventually, you ended up in Walla Walla.
Eventually, we ended up in Walla Walla, and we just got to work in the fields and picking onions, apples, everything. We started noticing that the families we came into that labor camp were getting their homes already. We're moving out of the labor camp. We were one of the last families from our group of people that came into that labor camp. So what can we do to bring in extra dough? And we started getting creative. My sister was really good at doing hair, my older sister. So she started charging, you know, or doing hair for women getting married, to young ladies going having their quinceañera, and she would do their hair. My other sister,
15th birthday.
Yeah, the 15th birthday. My other sister is a great dancer, so she would teach dance. My brother's a great artist. He would make art pieces, tattoo drawings. And I was sort of just the orchestrator, right? Like the manager, just managing these things. But tamales seemed like a really easy thing to do. We make them every Christmas and sometimes other parts of the year when we just have that craving. And teachers started asking for them at school. You know, I would bring them for lunch. That was my lunch. Everybody else was eating meatloaf and all these other things, and I was eating tamales. You know, someone asked for if they could buy some, and then that's just kind of where the light bulb went off in my head, and how we transitioned into that. And meanwhile, we were doing all these other things too, but it was out of that desire to want to have our own home.
Did you adapt your tamales to the market?
Oh, definitely. We made them less spicy because people couldn't handle the spiciness that we were making. So yeah, we adapted them, and the other way we adapted them was we raised the prices a little bit. We first started just doing $10 a dozen, and we started realizing like we could probably charge more because they're going to be willing to pay it, and we raised probably a little bit more than double the price on them. But it was, and that's sort of.
These people want less spice, and they'll pay more money.
Exactly. And sometimes that's how the funny part of business.
What's the number one thing people who want to start a small business that they don't understand?
Raising capital. Having the actual, a lot of people don't realize how much money it actually takes to start a business. And so it takes a lot of getting creative, right? If it's somebody that wants to do a full-blown restaurant, well, maybe we'll start with a truck first or something, right? Or maybe, or you know, it's getting them to think creatively because raising that capital is a tough piece. But even just one thing I've been really surprised about over the last few years that I've been working with small business owners is that a lot of people know their product, know what they're selling. They know how to cook whatever. They know how to cut hair, but they don't really understand how to run a business and how to grow year after year over year, you know, and or don't even have that goal of really growing year over year, you know, and that's the thing. And the more I talk to business owners, the more I realize it's not that uncommon that a business owner knows their product, knows how to run, you know, how to do what they do, but doesn't necessarily know marketing or how to run a business, you know, just the basics.
Give us an idea the range of small business entrepreneurs in Seattle. Who are you dealing with?
Yesterday I met with a photographer, and we're dealing with people who have who are physical coaches, you know, they want to have a gym. We're dealing with restaurant owners, barbers. We're dealing with coffee shop owners. We're dealing with bicycle repair folks, all kinds.
We started out talking about taking advantage of the new people coming into a gentrifying neighborhood with money to spend, mm-hmm. and you've got it. You've got some expertise, and these are your clients. Right. What do you tell people who they've got an expertise, their neighborhood is changing, new people are coming in? How do they adapt?
Well, part of it is part of running a business is knowing your clientele. Right. So if you have a new set of people coming in, is let's figure out who these people are, what they like.
What's an example of that?
Well, there's a restaurant in South Park that I'm working with. And she, the owner, her and her husband, you know, they've kind of always served the same people. And there hasn't been too much growth. But little by little, there's the Boeing workers are starting to kind of peak into South Park as an option for lunch, right? And how do you take advantage of that, right? How do you attract these folks? You know, sometimes you have to get really creative, and maybe you reach out to Boeing, right? But you know, that's one small example of just as Boeing continues to grow, you know, your neighbor Georgetown over here is getting a lot of business. Why aren't you? What are you doing differently, right? And so it's looking at those things and getting creative so that you're taking advantage of that clientele as well.
Is it ever awkward, that dance with a business person and new clientele who's just starting to check out the neighborhood?
Yeah, it is awkward. You know, there's a lot of pride in it, right? You have pride in the product you're serving, right? In this case, food, right? In this case, let's say it was tamales and we continued doing tamales or something. And for you to change those recipes, it's not always easy to just say, well, let me sell it to this new type of person who enjoys it a different way, right? Because now it's not real Mexican food, right? But I guess maybe that's the ugly side of business. In order to make some profit is change your product a little bit and adapt to the customer. And sometimes that means you have to let go of whatever you were doing before. But that's part of business.
So we're talking about somebody who's trying to make a living, having to change what they do and maybe what they love. What responsibility does the newcomer, the gentrifier, have?
To be a good neighbor, you know, get to know where you're moving into. Understand that there are people that are being kicked out, people that are having to leave and don't have a choice, right? And you're occupying now a space that a family might have been at before, and now you've sort of taken it over. I'm sure with not bad intentions, right? Because I'm not saying these people are bad people, right? They got a job in a city and they wanted to live in a certain place, and so they did it. But be conscious of the neighborhood you're moving into, its history, and support the mom and pop shops there, the people that have been there already. Because at the end of the day, we're all going to benefit from it.
That's Pedro Gomez, who works in Seattle's Office of Economic Development. We're tweeting out a link to our growth and development reporter Joshua McNichol's story about how neighbors are handling gentrification in South Seattle now. So join us on Twitter at KUOW. So Pedro and I were talking about the challenges and the promise of small business. I want to update you on a story of the hacking of small business. Last week, we told you this story of a Russian man accused of hacking into little retailers, mostly Washington State pizza joints, and stealing their credit card information. We talked about it with AP investigative reporter Martha Belisle last week. Well, a Seattle jury just convicted that man. Prosecutors called Roman Selesnyov one of the most prolific credit card traffickers in history, responsible for almost $170 million in losses around the world. Now he's convicted and could face up to 34 years in prison when he is sentenced in December. This is KUOW's The Record. A bunch of cowards. That's the phrase that finally got U.S. soccer player Hope Solo suspended. The Seattle Reign goalie called the Swedish soccer team cowards after Sweden beat her and her American teammates at the Rio Olympics. U.S. soccer has suspended Solo for 6 months. The host of Slate's podcast, The Gist, Mike Pesca, says the suspension is not just about the cowards' remark. It's also about Hope Solo's past.
In 2014, she was arrested for physically assaulting her sister and her nephew, her teenage nephew. That's still, it's still winding its way in the courts in one stage or another, that case. Then she was involved in a domestic dispute with her husband, Jeremy Stevens, formerly of the UW Huskies. Though we should say that she was the victim, it would seem, although no charges were brought. And then later on, just recently, her husband was involved in a DUI, and the van with her in the car, and the van he was driving was a U.S. national women's team van. Before the Olympics, she was tweeting a lot of pictures of her preparing with like giant, almost cartoon-like cans of insect repellent and netting, because she said she was afraid of Zika. I mean, there's a good way and a bad way to handle that. That certainly was undiplomatic. And then after the loss, the surprising loss of the U.S. national team to Sweden, she said the better team lost that day, meaning the Americans. And she called the Swedes cowards because of a defensive style of play, which was really a smart defensive style of play. In fact, Sweden used that style of play to win a silver medal. So that was real sour grapes, and that was very unsportsmanlike.
So the Swedish team is not actually cowardly.
It turns out that they have valor on their sides and intelligence, yes.
So then what is U.S. soccer actually punishing Hope Solo for?
Actually, the comments, which were an embarrassment. She also lashed out at former players on the team. She's done that before. But this was one in a series, the series of events that I laid out. And I get the sense that she went into this being told she was on some version of double secret probation, or at least she should have known that she had a short leash and they were yanking it back. So that's why we're seeing the suspension. It was the comments. It was comments embarrassing to the United States and the U.S. national women's team.
So then let's talk about the yanking. 6 month suspension, 3 month severance, and Solo still gets to play for the Seattle Reign, which gets a lot of its money from the U.S. Soccer Federation. So how severe is the punishment?
She has a $150,000 a year contract, roughly. So 6 months means she loses half of that. But you mentioned the severance, so it would seem she gains about half of that still. It's weird. The Reign is subsidized. Her salary is subsidized by the U.S. Soccer Federation. And the thinking there is it's important to keep these well-known soccer players in the public eye, and the professional women's league is not that wealthy. So let's have U.S. soccer subsidize some of that. And that's not going to be touched. So she'll still be playing for the Seattle Reign.
And maybe she's done with the Olympics and World Cup anyway. Is she getting up there as athletes do?
Yes. And that's another really important thing, because for so long, people countenanced Hope Solo because she was a great player. That, by the way, transcends sexism, right? Men have that favoritism visited upon them, too, when they're big pains in the neck. But man, can they bash a baseball or, you know, dunk a basketball. But yeah, she is aging out of her prime. And who knows in 2020 if there'll be another great younger goaltender to take her place. She's not old in real life. She's 35. But in soccer terms, you know, who knows as a 39-year-old if she would be the best option for the U.S. in 2020.
So you could argue that the Soccer Federation might be, I don't know, cowardly?
Well, I don't know. I think it was truly embarrassing. And of all the athletes, I went on a TV program and they said, who are the three biggest losers? And of course, Ryan Lochte takes one of those spots. And my mind immediately went to Hope Solo. Like, what a disappointment. Teams win, teams lose. But especially in Olympics on the public stage, there's a way to comport yourself. And she did a really bad job. There are a couple things that transcend the Olympics because we still have a romanticism attached to the Olympics. And Hope Solo's comments were, I do think, an ugly embarrassment for her nation, her federation, and her team.
You mentioned Ryan Lochte, a male misbehaving star. Is there a double standard here?
Well, you know, the idea of double standard has come up with Hope Solo before, because when she was arrested for her assault, people said, isn't there a double standard? We have these NFL players arrested and they're being suspended, and Solo was made to, you know, sit out a game. And then there was an argument, well, it's different if males using their privilege to abuse females. That's the past argument. This argument is, of course, top of mind is Ryan Lochte, this athlete who certainly embarrassed the United States and may have actually been involved in criminality, if you believe the filing of a false police report. There's a question about that. He didn't go to the police. They went to him. However, two things. One, swimming might still suspend Ryan Lochte. That hasn't come down. And two, he lost. He had a lot more money in endorsements, but he lost a lot more money in endorsements than Hope Solo did. But three, I'm still willing to concede that there might be a double standard, that a woman speaking out in this way might somehow chafe at the sports federation more than a male would. Can't prove it. Something to think about.
I think there's a certain amount of forgiving the sports star who's your local sports star happening in Seattle.
Sure, sure. And I do get the fact there is a part of me that says she's getting punished for speech, and her speech wasn't, you know, hate speech, wasn't an incitement to violence, wasn't a slur of any sort. She's been a sore loser, and she lost half her salary for just being a sore loser. Don't we have a space for being a sore loser? I think that if she did that in a non-Olympic context, and as someone who hadn't made all these mistakes before, would be getting a different story.
All right. Well, so I suppose you could call this a slap on the wrist, although Hope Solo wears really thick gloves.
Yeah, hamburger helper hands. Yeah.
I'm not sure she'd even feel a slap on the wrist. That was Mike Pesca, the host of Slate's podcast, The Gist, discussing Seattle goalie Hope Solo, who was once suspended for a month from the U.S. soccer team. Now she's out for 6 months and might have played in her final Olympics and World Cup. Who knows? We can still see her here on the Seattle Reign. You're listening to The Record on KUOW. From Seattle rain now to Seattle sightseeing. Smith Tower reopens today in Pioneer Square, which is an important turnaround for this 1914 landmark building that was once the tallest building west of the Mississippi. You could say the Smith Tower hit rock bottom after the recession, when plans to turn it into condos didn't pan out and banks foreclosed on this famous wedding cake of a building. KUOW's Joshua McNichols took a tour of Smith Tower to learn some of its history.
That's where I met Ned Carner, vice president of Unico, the company that bought Smith Tower. Carner met me in the Smith Tower lobby. He told me the building's materials reflect the huge ego of the building's original owner.
The lobby is covered in onyx. Everything in the whole building was designed to kind of reflect the most ostentatious and most popular styles of the time.
Who was this guy, Mr. Smith of Smith Tower? Was he got his money selling guns and typewriters, right?
That's right. Smith initially made his money in guns, sold that business, and then started Corona Typewriters, which was really where he made the majority of his money.
Okay, so he made a lot of money, and he wanted to put a mark on Seattle real estate and threw a lot of ostentatious ornamentation into this building. Can you tell me about the elevator door? I mean, they kind of remind me of something you see, like, I don't know, I don't want to say it, but in Trump Tower or something. Yeah.
The gold doors all are engraved with the L.C. Smith. They're pretty gaudy. They're completely designed to impress. The elevators themselves are designated as a historic landmark, so they will be saved perpetually. Another very unique factor is that they are manually operated, so each elevator has a operator.
Get ready for a historical ride in Seattle. We're headed up to the observatory. You'll be able to see when you go up there, there's actually film footage of a one-armed stuntman named Mink Duranda. And his dream was to jump off of the Smith Tower and to pull a parachute. And he asked for a permit, which he couldn't receive, so he did it anyway, and he said it was an accident. You can actually see that.
Elevator operator Leslie Holdcroft is full of stories like that. Before we went into the observatory, Unico's Ned Carner pulled me into a locked room where all the elevator machinery is. It sounds like this.
Okay. It's a freaky noise.
Yeah.
It's not what I would expect in an elevator machine room. What the heck is happening?
So this is the technology of the times. So they're using electric arch to decide what floor everything is going to.
Basically, they didn't have modern transistors. Instead, they had this old-fashioned mechanical version of a transistor.
As everything's switching, you start to see bright flashes of light that look like lightning, and it is perfectly safe. They're maintained by Otis, as they have been for over 100 years. They're certified, they're inspected by the city, and they are safe, but it is very different than you're accustomed to.
Okay, what does that tell us about, like, restoring an old building like this?
I liken a little bit to probably restoring an old car. You have to look very carefully to find the pieces. So if a similar elevator in another city is removed, we will buy the pieces. Or we have to manufacture pieces in order to keep them running on occasion.
Finally, we head to the observation platform for a view of the city. Down below us is Pioneer Square. After this building was built, downtown really moved north. That's part of the reason the Smith Tower sticks out so much down here. Carner admits that the only investor who ever really made money off this building is the company that bought it in foreclosure after the recession. They doubled their money when they sold it to Unico. But Carner thinks this building has the potential to go further, because all the funky stuff he showed me, the carved Indian heads in the lobby, the gold monogrammed doors, the stories about people who tried to parachute off it, it all adds up to character. And people will pay for character these days.
This is a unique place, and it attracts people looking for something that feels different, that feels special, and kind of connects with them at an emotional level.
The owner also hopes curious visitors will shell out $20 for a self-guided tour of the building. That's almost as much as it costs to visit the Space Needle. But here's a secret if you're cheap, like me. There's a bar in the observation deck, and you can get in there for only $10. In Pioneer Square, I'm Joshua McNichols, KUOW News.
Coming up this afternoon on KUOW, we're going to check in on people hit by earthquake in Italy and by flooding in Louisiana, and we are being reminded again how open Americans are to a world of grain beyond wheat and rice. Is amaranth the new quinoa? That's coming up this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Back in the 1930s, tribal fishing villages lined the banks of the Columbia River. You can see old photos showing two-story wooden houses and fish nets and salmon drying on racks. When the Bonneville Dam was built, those fishing villages went underwater. Today, tribal fishers live above the new water line at sites that are not meant for human habitation. Well, some new legislation aims to change that. Reporter Kate Prangeman with the Yakima Herald Republic went to a few of the sites near the Bonneville Dam to see how these tribal fishers are living.
People are living in small trailers and, hand-built homes that lack water and sometimes lack electricity. And there are bathhouses that were designed for day use only, and that provides the water for up to a dozen families in some cases for all of their bathing and cooking and cleaning needs. So there's a lot of hazards. At one of the sites I visited, a home actually burned down because the fire hydrant on the property was not actually connected to a water source. So really substandard conditions at most of these sites.
Why are people living like this?
Well, you talk to different people and you'll hear some different reasons, but what I heard most from tribal members was that they either chose to stay in these places or return to them after their families were kicked off a generation before, because living along the river is, you know, the way of life for their people forever, and they don't want to lose that, you know, connection to their ancestors and their history. So a lot of these families originally resisted moving to the reservation generations ago and chose to stay by the river, and they're continuing to fight for that because they're afraid if they leave, you know, they'll never be allowed back. Johnny Jackson, a Yakima elder that I spoke with at length, told me that he'd been living at one of these sites for 40 years because he knew that if he left, you know, he'd never be able to argue that his people should be allowed to return.
Kate, let's tell the story of how this problem began. What happened?
Well, so what happened was when Bonneville Dam was built, it flooded a lot of traditional fishing sites and villages, some villages that were used, you know, during fishing season, some that were used year-round and had, you know, complete homes of the very modern homes of the era. But when the dam was built, you know, this is a different era in the federal government's history, and they didn't really think about the fact that they had an obligation to relocate the people who were displaced. The Army Corps of Engineers historian told me that at the time, tribal leaders really pushed for fishing access, because the tribal leaders were based on these reservations where most tribal members lived, and fishing access was the most important for them. And so the issue of housing for the hundreds of people who were living along the river sort of got lost in that negotiation. And then more dams got built and more villages got flooded, and then the issue has just grown.
So there are two pieces of federal legislation proposed here. If they're passed, what changes?
Yeah, well, one piece of legislation would immediately move, if passed, to address some of these basic safety and sanitation needs, you know, such as more adequate water supply, fire hydrants, that sort of thing. And that, if passed, it could move quite quickly to address some of the problems. The other piece would be funding to study and develop a housing plan. So that's going to be a little bit slower, you know, progress, because these issues are so complicated, but it would definitely get the ball rolling on finding what some long-term solutions would look like.
Kate, this started because of broken promises from the federal government. Why should we think the federal government is going to solve it now?
Well, that's a good question. The Corps of Engineers told me that if Congress directs them to address this problem, they are prepared to work with tribal leadership to do so if there's direction and funding provided to the Corps. They're ready to do this. So it's a question of political will, I think, for sure. So there's a lot of things that need to happen, but there's a lot of energy around the issue now, and the next step is going to be for tribal leaders to figure out if the federal government does come through with its promise to provide funding and build housing, who is that housing going to go to? Is it going to go to families that the tribes can identify who were displaced generations ago? Is it going to go to families who are living in these substandard conditions along the river now? You know, what's an equitable way for them to you know, help their communities move forward with this as well? So there's a lot of work still to be done on this issue.
So you went there to report about these broken promises from the federal government with these tribes and at a federal solution. And are you saying you found that this is going to be even more complicated than you thought?
Well, I think that the solution is going to be, yes, very complicated, because if Congress does say, you know, we're going to recognize our obligation here and we're going to provide some money, then there's, you know, years of conversation between the leadership of four different tribal nations to figure out, you know, where best to put housing, who's going to be able to take advantage of that housing, And so there's a lot to come on this issue.
Yakima Herald Republic reporter Kate Prangeman, and we're tweeting out a link to her story right now at KUOW. And speaking of life on the water, have you heard about how the Arctic is opening up because of melting ice? This week, the biggest commercial cruise ship ever to attempt the Northwest Passage starts sailing. This is the historically impassable sea route over the top of Canada. A 1,600-person, 13-deck cruise ship called the Crystal Serenity left Alaska last week on its way to New York City. The ship's captain visited some of the small Arctic communities along the way and said they are apprehensively excited about the onslaught of visitors. You can find the story at KUOW.org. Thanks for tuning in to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Volunteer Park is about to stink. The conservatory there got a new resident last month, a so-called corpse flower. This fragrant flower is on loan from the University of Washington Biology Department, where Terry Huang is a greenhouse attendant.
A corpse flower is a relative of a calla lily, and it's the world's largest inflorescence, unbranched inflorescence. So that means it's a giant flowering stem. So it's not one flower, but there's lots of little flowers at the base of it tucked inside that little collar. But it's one of the biggest flowers in the world, so to speak.
And let's get right at what this thing smells like, shall we?
Yes. Well, they've analyzed the compounds, and it smells like old, moldy gym socks mixed in with rotten onions and cabbage. And you have a bit of fecal matter and rotten fish. So imagine that all slurried together, and you have this wonderful concoction of putridness.
Well said.
Thank you.
I love, by the way, that putrid bloom is related to the calla lily.
Yes, right.
In your list, I didn't hear the word corpse in there.
So I think people say corpse because it just smells like death and rot. And so that's where it comes from. And actually, the local name in Indonesia, the local people call it, it literally translates to corpse flower. And so that's where that name comes from.
Mm-hmm. So a little rotted flesh in there, too.
Oh, yeah.
For you. You're welcome. The corpse flower has a story to it.
Mm-hmm.
What's the story?
So the story is that it's actually incredibly rare, and it comes from the western rainforests of Sumatra. They usually grow on hillsides, so they have good drainage. So part of the reason why it's hard to grow is that you don't want it to rot. So there's this kind of moment where you have to get enough water, but not too much, to get it to grow. So it's incredibly rare. They bloom whenever they get enough energy because the flowers are so big. They can grow up to 10 feet or more in the wild. They have reports of bigger ones.
10
but,
feet.
Amazing, right? Yeah. So bigger than a human.
Yeah.
And so to power that flower or to create that flower, they need a lot of energy. So during their off season, they produce a single leaf, and the leaf looks like a palm tree. And the leaf can be about 12 feet tall and 12 feet wide just to photosynthesize. And it's storing all this energy underground in this giant potato-like tuber. And it can weigh up to about 150 pounds or a bit more. And when it's ready, has enough energy, it produces the giant flower. And to make things a bit more complicated for the plant, it also burns its carbohydrates, so it produces heat. If you get a chance to ever see one in the wild, if you get close to it on the first night, it kind of feels like a human body because it's warm. And that's to get the volatile oils off of it, that horrible scent, so it can float off into the very still jungle air to attract all the pollinators.
Why does the corpse flower smell so much and badly?
As plants, you're kind of rooted in one place. You can't pick up to get food or drink water or to find a mate. And for most plants, to find a mate, you have to attract your pollinators. And so this plant has evolved to attract sweat bees, flies, and carrion beetles. And they're not entirely sure which one of the three, but they're assuming there's a mixture, mostly the carrion beetles, that come and pollinate the flower. And so the plant has this amazing ability to make itself smell like it's a carcass. And so these pollinators come thinking there's food, but while they're down there, they accidentally pollinate the flower, and then the flower can get pollinated, and then they leave knowing that there's no food later. And so that's how that plant takes care of the problem of finding a mate if you can't get up. You just have to send out the right signal and convince everybody to come.
Convince everybody.
Yep.
This plant is so relatable. It's as big as a person. It doesn't always smell great. And you make it sound like it's got a personality, you know? It's trying to convince the world of what it needs.
Oh, it definitely has a personality. It Because it, a part of its mystique is you never know when it's ready to bloom. And so we did not anticipate having one really blooming. So we were hoping, actually. We're hoping before the greenhouse was demolished to make way for a new one, it would bloom. But now that we've moved the collection, of course it decided to bloom. And they just take so much energy to bloom. So that's part of the reason why you're not sure. And when it's actually producing the flower, so it's up at the conservatory right now, and it's growing about an inch a day, the flower itself. And we're still not entirely sure when the exact day is it when it blooms, because it just, I guess, the plant has a sense of when it's ready, and then it will open that night.
And when it opens, that's when it stinks?
Yeah, so opening night is the worst smell you could probably imagine. But then the next day, if you come in the next day and you visit it, it won't be as bad. But the first night is the most pungent.
You've personally smelled one?
Not on the first night. I have on the second day. So I'm hoping I'll still be here. Actually, I'm leaving in a week to go to grad school. But I'm hoping it'll bloom in time so I can smell on the first night, because it's something on my list that I've been wanting to smell, if you can believe it or not.
Yeah, it's on your bucket list. You're hoping you're still going to be there
yes.
when the flesh first rots.
Yes.
When the fecal cheese first wafts, you want to be there.
Yes, I do.
How much notice do you get?
So probably the day of the conservatory will make a tweet, and hopefully whoever sees that will be able to go down and see it. It's incredible that you can wait up to 10 years for this thing to bloom, and the flower lasts just 2 days, 2 to 3 days, and then it collapses, and that's it. And you wait again for another however long until it's ready to bloom again.
So there might be tweets. And if you're downwind, you'll know.
Yes,
well.
Definitely.
Will people flock to this plant when it blooms in Volunteer Park?
I think, yeah, quite a few people. It seems like, especially when we had one bloom in 2011, and we had a line that went out the greenhouse, out the door, and kind of around the block. And it was amazing. Everyone just wanted to see this and smell it. And so... And it does take a particular person, I think, to want to go and see a plant that smells like a corpse.
What kind of person is that?
Person like me, I think.
And that is?
Someone who has curiosity of the natural world and just wanting to know and seeing this amazing thing that doesn't happen very often. And we're so far away from Sumatra. When are you ever going to get a chance to smell a corpse flower?
You got that chance now. And telling you about it there was Terry Wong, greenhouse attendant for the University of Washington Biology Greenhouse. So look for news about when the corpse flower will bloom on the Volunteer Park Conservatory's website. We'll tweet out a link to that right now, at KUOW. They're also going to announce the blooming on Twitter, so you can follow them, at VP Conservatory. Now, I was joking with Terry there about the corpse flower being on his bucket list. He wants to be there on opening night of corpse bloom. Maybe not your dream, but it's his. I also talked about personal dreams with our next guest. On her 50th birthday, she wrote a list of 50 things she has always wanted to do but has never done because she's been afraid. These were not necessarily monumental goals. They might be little things.
Learn to play catch. Go whitewater rafting. Hold a big snake. Smoke or eat pot. Ride on a motorcycle. Ride in a helicopter. Go to a developing country.
That's Mary Elder listing the fears that stop her. And she told me what got her in the mindset to face down her little tiny fears.
Coming into 50, the big turning point was when I thought, what if I have 50 more years? I mean, I guess that's optimistic, but what if I do? And what am I going to do with those years? Because now, the second 50, they're not about pleasing my parents or raising my children or being responsible to a boss or an employer or whatever.
Right, you're not launching your career.
Yeah, I just get to think about what it might include. And it was the sky was the limit. And then as soon as the sky was the limit, it shut right down. Like, it was just like whoosh, because I thought, like, I could save the rainforest. And then my next thought was, like, except that I really don't like snakes. It wasn't like I'm not a naturalist. I don't know the first thing about rainforest. The first thing was like, yeah, but what if I saw a snake?
Your fear stood between you and your
Immediately
dreams?
Immediately, I felt that way. Like, oh, I, you know, all these little fears just, like, make it so that I don't even contemplate what might be. And so I thought, well, I feel like my purpose lies on the other side of saying, let's rip off the bubble wrap. Let's just grab the gusto and just conquer the little ones, because the big ones are out there, but you can't even get to the big stuff until you know that fear is not something to turn away from, but to face.
Can we talk about a few of your fears? Sounds like a therapy session. Let's talk about your fears, Mary.
So some examples of fears that are on my mind. And again, I wrote all 50 very quickly. It was just a rush to, my husband said, I bet you have three fears. And I said, watch this. Like 10 minutes later, I had 50. So run a marathon, submit poems to the New Yorker, sing karaoke. I have a lot of those kind of things where it's like, what I fear is falling on my chin, you know, being rejected, of trying something and having the whole world see that it didn't work. Why do you even try? What were you thinking? Who do you think you are? All that garbage. And I think that that putting them on the list, it doesn't mean that I'm going to be successful. It doesn't mean that I'm going to be fearless. It just means that I am not. The time is short.
It doesn't mean you're going to be successful. In fact, you submitted to the New Yorker.
I did.
And they didn't care.
That's right. They said no. It's funny because the New Yorker was like a super long shot. But I think there's a part of me that thought I could put these in a little publication or give them out at Mariners games, write them on a bathroom stall. I could share them. But what if they could have been in the New Yorker? And I think that's another theme in this list is I think there's some things you got to get out of your system, like throw it out there. Maybe the New Yorker wants this. Or I have, write and perform a stand-up comedy act, which I guess you've done some of.
I have done that.
Well, that, you know, the most hardcore Iron Man friends of mine, when they're like, I've climbed a mountain, I've run a marathon. If I say yes, but have you done stand up? They're like, no, I'm not crazy. Right. But, for me, it's like it's okay if I get booed off the stage. What's not okay is that I think it could be fun. And the 49-year-old me was willing to just have life happen without even trying it out.
I want to understand. It's not a bucket list, meaning these are not things that you, fantastic things you can't wait to do.
Not at all.
You just are sick of being afraid.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you know the difference between a fear you should face and a fear you should avoid?
Like,
you think you should face every fear you have and do it? Anyway,
I guess that most of these fears are symbolic. You know, people ask me all the time, like, oh, are you jumping out of an airplane? Are you cliff diving? Or like, they go to these extreme fears for them. And to me, just jumping into water from a height is one of those things I have never wanted to do. And I feel like if I am ever in the, Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid situation.
The Bolivian Army has you outnumbered.
Right. When that happens, I want to know, oh, yeah, I've done this. This is, let's go, Sundance. Let's hold hands. And I don't really need to cliff dive in order to be ready for that. I just need to know that I can do this stuff.
Okay. So this is what we want to know.
Mm.
You've faced many of your fears, and it's changed you how? And how can we learn from it?
The most important thing I've learned is that when I feel fear, not to turn away from it, but to go toward it.
What's an example of how you've made that change has happened in you?
Every day. This morning, I called my senators about the gun legislation, and it's the kind of thing that I might have in the past said, I don't really know how to navigate that. I don't know about taking a stand. And, I got arrested for a good cause. That was on my list.
And what did you get arrested for?
I got arrested at the Bangor nuclear base for stepping over the line that they guard there and saying, I object to nuclear proliferation, to having this very, very dangerous base right in the heart of Puget Sound that is hidden from us and not talked about. And to me, the importance of facing that fear was to say, you know, I was born during the civil rights movement. I went to college during apartheid. I was raised in a New Hampshire where saying your political beliefs felt kind of inappropriate sometimes or risky. And I wanted to live out loud. I wanted to learn to live out loud. And so that was a protest that I participated in. But the importance of it for me was to say, when I believe something and that purpose that lies out there beyond this list, if it involves taking the risk that so many people have taken in order to create change in our culture, if that's part of my future, I don't want to be afraid of it. I want to step in and have a voice. And it has changed me. I get up in the morning and I say, well, bring it. Let's do this. This is what I do, is put myself out there.
Mary Elder made a list of 60 fears she would like to conquer in order to live a fuller life. And you can find out how she's doing at her website, Facing 50 Fears. That's the number 50, facing50fears.com. Thanks for tuning in today to KUOW's The Record. If you missed any part of the show, you didn't really miss it, because you can get our podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for tuning in.